giving you an overview of what work Tate Exchange is. So Tate Exchange essentially lets us have the floor of the building for a week every year. It does it with lots of arts organisations to facilitate kind of discussion and engagement. And this year's overall theme for the whole year was production. And so ours was about the production of truth, the production of history, and the production of mental distress in prison particularly, which comes out of a project that Hilary Marland and her colleague, Associate Professor Catherine Cox in the corner there, who we'll hear more about in a bit, are running, called Prisoners, Medical Care and Entitlement to Health in England and Ireland from 1850 to now. It's a 5-year research project funded by the Wellcome Trust, and it involves Warwick University, the University College Dublin, Dublin City University, and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And over our time, we've been looking at aspects of history in prison, including HIV, youth offending and youth imprisonment, welfare and reform organisations, medical care and staff, and particularly at Warwick, we've been looking at, Hilary and Catherine have been looking at mental health in prison, Rachel has been looking at, maternity and women's experiences in prison, and another colleague who couldn't be here today has been looking at nutrition and medical care and has done the past time display. So I'm going to let the panel members introduce themselves. I'm sure they can tell you more about themselves than me. I'll start with Kate.
Hi, I'm Kate McGraw. I'm director of Fuel, which is a producing organisation. Our roots are in theatre, so most of the work that we do is working with theatre makers, but often in cross-art form ways. I guess that we try and work with artists who are interested in understanding the world better, and so quite often that means the work is always new, it's always contemporary, and quite often we work with scientists and academics who are researching areas related to the work that we're doing and bring them to. I suppose essentially I think that our most interesting artists and scientists are trying to explore and understand the world, and we're interested in different perspectives, so if we're able to bring those thoughts together, maybe we'll have kind of different understandings that come out of them. So that's kind of why we got involved.
Hi, I'm Paula Varzek. I'm an artist that works in a number of different art forms, primarily theatre, but also video and spoken word, and sometimes all those things at once. I suppose my practice has a social focus. It's largely interested in communities and what makes communities, but also identity and the politics of identity. And it generally has a research basis. So before I was a theatre maker, I was a documentary maker. I often have quite extensive research periods, sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years, before I decide on the form and make a piece of work. But this was the first time I worked on a research-based project, collaborating with researchers, so that was a really exciting new point for me to play with.
So Flo has already really introduced me. I'm Hilary Marland, and I'm one of the PIs with Catherine Cox from University College Dublin on the project on prison health, funded by the Wellcome Trust. And with Catherine, I'm working particularly on the strand of research on mental health in prison, which explores this topic from the mid-19th century up to the current day. And my previous work, another project with Catherine, has looked at Irish migration and mental illness. And I'm also very interested in women and mental illness, and particularly disorders impacting on women after they've given birth. So what used to be called puerperal insanity, very hard to say, in the 19th century, which is known more broadly as postnatal depression or postpartum psychosis sometimes today.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bennett, and I'm a postdoctoral research fellow on the Warwick side of the Prisons Project, and I work on the history of women's health in prison. So I'm particularly interested in maternity care and experiences of motherhood in prison, but I also look at how women's health needs have been identified and advocated for and how these things have shifted over time.
So I'm going to start with Hilary about, normally your work could be disseminated through kind of journals and academic conferences, so why disseminate your work through arts and why choose audio?
Well, it was part of the conditions of our grant, I guess, because we're funded by the Wellcome Trust, who are very, very keen on public engagement. And when they fund research, their expectation is that associated with the research, there will be a huge effort by the team to produce innovative public engagement. And at Warwick and UCD, we're also extremely keen on this approach. So this is something that's almost second nature. So on this project and previous grants, we've worked with museums, we've worked with theatre companies. We've worked mainly with more visual and, I guess, projects that involve audiences. So it was really interesting to us. First of all, I should say we were delighted Fuel agreed to work with us. It's really exciting when they said, yes, this is interesting and we'd like to be part of this. I mean, the reason for choosing audio, I mean, one reason is we hadn't done it before, because, as I mentioned, we'd done things like theatre, done three theatre productions over the last few years, which involve an audience and involve people, the script writer, the director, working very, very closely with our documentation, in a way translating that into another media. But what we agreed to do with Fuel is that they would respond to our work. So that was rather different. They wouldn't go away and rewrite it and produce an audio. They would produce something which their particular response to our research and the conversations we'd had. And I think audio, it's a provides a very intense, immersive experience, and it was very nice that we were able to offer something that people could experience on an individual level. And the responses have been quite interesting this week. The work has just gone on show here. It hasn't been, it was prepared specifically for Tate Exchange. And the final thing is you can move it around. A lot of people can listen to it. We can do it as podcasts maybe later. We can go to different venues. So that was quite exciting for us as well, that we would be able to reach a lot of people through audio installations.
Okay. So, Kate, how did you approach the brief interview? What was it? Because you've obviously done stuff with academics before. How did you approach it?
It was very exciting to be asked, so thank you for approaching us. It connected with lots of other sort of areas of work that we were doing. Partly, as you say, we've worked with academics and researchers, particularly in biomedical science, but also in various other areas like physics and social anthropology and things, over the years. Initially, I suppose it began through working with artists who are curious about the world and who were kind of delving into a particular area and wanted to, you know, find out more from people who really knew about that area. So it was kind of led from the art, as it were, and then we'd find people that they would research with. And over the years, we've, you know, built relationships with academics and researchers and really started to be interested in what the possibilities are for it kind of happening the other way around, if you like, this. So they've got some interesting research and what might we do with it. So it was really fantastic to be approached with that provocation. We've done this extraordinary and fascinating research, and what would you do with it to engage the public in it? And then, as you say, our instinct is always to, I guess, create some freedom for the artist to respond, to bring their practice and their interests and to that process, as opposed to kind of use their craft to convey the information in the research. Partly, because that's how you kind of get the most out of brilliant artists, but also because the research in itself is really compelling. So you could just, you know, read it and look at the extraordinary images as part of it. It's not, you know, it's very accessible, actually, I've found. So it was kind of like, what can we bring to this and how can we connect it? Some of that was about engagement and a feeling that maybe academic research sometimes feels a bit kind of a challenge for people if they're not kind of used to engaging in research in that way, and finding a way that people could engage first through a podcast and then maybe be interested to find out more. And I guess the next stage for us was about kind of identifying what aspects, because there's like a huge amount of research, so kind of thinking about what aspects of that we would most interested in. So I said we're most interested in women, because we are at the moment doing a lot of work around increasing representation of women on stage and behind the scenes. And it feels like, I mean, this year of work that we're doing is all about the future and thinking about feminism and gender, and as part of that feels really important, and there was some really interesting research in those areas. So we kind of latched onto that. And I guess the audio thing partly made sense because we've done a a few projects. We've done a lot of work using audio in different ways, headphone based or immersive projects. And in particular, we'd made three series of podcasts, which were connecting artists and scientists together, and all around this kind of short form, kind of 10-minute experiences. But they were very different from this, but having had that experience, it felt like there was a form that we were kind of evolving and interested in that we could try and work in a different way with. So yeah. And then who will we commission?
Well, I was going to say, so I don't know how many people know about it, but actually we have the absolutely fabulous Gareth Fry, who's just won a Tony for Harry Potter, which we're contractually obliged to say, I think, now is second. So he sound designed the whole set, but actually you have got three women writers, performers, and I wonder, was that deliberate?
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, apart from Gareth being so utterly brilliant, it was a bit of a shame not to have a woman. But he was brilliant, and we've worked with him in that way before, and he was very, very interested in the project, actually, before we'd defined it as being purely women. So we thought we could really sack him. And I think, you know, behind every brilliant woman, you know, she's supposed to have a helping hand. I definitely wanted to commission women artists to create the material in response. And it felt as though it was also about the particular relationships with the material and the artists that we commissioned. So it was, they were, you know, each of the three artists were chosen very specifically around the themes that we'd identified we wanted to work on. So there was some really interesting research around maternity and mental health and well-being, and that felt like a particular kind of strand in the research to kind of pick out, and around solitary confinement, which was really interesting, partly because I guess it takes many forms, so it's not technically legal anymore, is that right? But it still kind of happens in various ways and obviously has a big history, and that felt interesting to me, also connected to mental health. And then around kind of breaking out or resistance, that also felt like historically an interesting thing, but also it's interesting in a contemporary context, I guess, to think about what that means today. And so in each case, you know, I kind of quite carefully identified an artist that we knew their work, but also their kind of areas of interest, which connected in some way with each of those things.
So Rachel touched briefly, Kate touched briefly on the materials that were available. Rachel, what sort of materials did we make available to Fiona, say, take your pick?
Yeah, so as with most historical research, research into prisons requires you to draw from a lot of different areas. So you have to draw a lot of different kind of records and discourse to kind of build a picture of what is going on in prisons. So we've used official reports, so these would be compiled by governors and chaplains and medical officers. So we've used those to try and gain an insight into how they want to run the system, how they want to set the system up, but also the tensions involved in that. But we've also tried to, where we can, uncover an often concealed or very heavily mediated voice of the prisoners themselves. So we've looked at prisoner memoirs, which are things that are usually written by prisoners when they leave prison. So we've got some by men, but we've got a couple of particularly nice ones that were written by women. So we've tried to build up, and they talk quite a lot about other people and what they observe in the prison. So that's been quite a nice record that we've made use of for the audio pieces. We also use things like newspapers, or we use things like diaries, or we use things, just things that contemporaries might write, so journalists or social reformers. And it kind of gives you an idea of the outside looking in, what people think prison should be, and then we contrast it with the reality of what prison is in practice. So really, we have to build it up from a lot of different areas. So there's not just one archive or one particular way to look at this. You have to... It's a bit of a searching task. You have to kind of go around it and build the picture up from a lot of composite materials, which I think is nice because you can build up different perspectives and different interpretations, and sometimes those differ. You know, one person might think of something one way and another person has a different interpretation, so again, we can really draw out the tensions between the rhetoric and the reality of prison life. So that's the kind of stuff we've passed on to the artists and asked them to interpret, and I think we've had some really good responses that really draw out, I think, these shifting but enduring tensions in the prison system.
So So could you just talk a little bit about the Duchess of Bedford report, which I think is 100 years old this year. Sorry, that's why I'm not an academic. Broadly, that would do. 100 years old this year, but actually there's lots of resonance between that and the Corston report, which is 10 years old last year, wasn't it?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that really quickly, because I know there's more information on the banners, but just briefly.
So it was in 1919, so after the First World War, there was a government push to improve conditions in Holloway Prison because there'd been some high-profile cases of, you know, mistreatment, but women had come out and there'd been reports of them not receiving very good medical care in prison, including pregnant women. So the Duchess of Bedford, who was a notable social reformer at the time, and she'd done a lot of work with women in the community, she was commissioned by the Prison Commission to form a team and go into the prison and conduct an inquiry into medical care, but it actually turned into mainly into maternity care and the maternity care offered to women and new mothers. So the report was done in 1919, so the centenary is obviously coming up next year, and some of the common things that came out of it were issues around choice, access to care, identifying pregnancy and the needs of pregnant women and new mothers and how that hadn't been done and how that could be changed, access to maternity staff. So a big outcome from the inquiry was that initially they had two women had to be midwives, certified midwives in Holloway, but by the 1930s all of the hospital staff were midwives, so that was something that came out of the inquiry. But also things about having special places in the prison to accommodate pregnant women and to observe pregnant women and make sure that they had access to emergency care should they need it. But it does resonate a bit with the Corston report, which was 10 years old last year, which was still talking about how women need a more holistic approach almost, and they need a different approach to the system that was set up for men. And the report in 1919 spoke about this and how women needed, you know, they needed more almost care and more understanding and more sympathy in the prison system that they weren't necessarily getting. And I think that is something that has endured for the last 100 years, and it was also brought out in the Corston report where they talked about how the system is almost still just a modified version of that which was created for men, and we need to shift it for women.
Brilliant, thank you. So Paula Varjak is the artist responsible for an amazing piece called In the Time After the Raid, which is the booth piece you'll see, which I know some of you have experienced. So when you were approached with a pile of dusty old documents, What interested you? What was in there that was, and how did you approach that kind of massive material?
The thing is, as I said, I quite enjoy really drowning in lots of material. So the best part about it is that someone else had collated it for me, and I could just ask. I could just say, "Oh, Hillary Rachel, could I please have more on this?" But I think the thing that I got most drawn to really early on were actually the gaps and the holes in the research. And when I say that, I don't mean in terms of these are very, very accomplished women. So it's not like I'm saying they haven't done their work. It's not that. But it just, there's so many times I had this ongoing thing, especially with Hillary, where I'd say, well, is there anything on a riot that happened? And she said, yeah, no, not really, it's true. I'm like, well, is there not anything written about a time where a documents of resistance, is someone like not making note of every time someone's, I was like, no, not really, like, okay. And there was lots of that. And then I got really fascinated in all these things that weren't covered, and then we started to move to our areas where Hillary would say, okay, well, actually, so there's this has been written about these two men who broke out, and we can kind of infer from that. So suddenly, I guess, very early on, I was very interested in what hasn't been covered, why hasn't it been covered, and then starting to imagine the stories within those gaps.
Well, that's the nature of truth, isn't it? Who's writing the story? Who's telling the story? The nature of history, isn't it, I suppose, what you pick up. You said you were really touched by the Borstal records, the Aylesbury Women's Borstal.
Well, yes, that for me, that's like a perfect example of a story in the gap, because we were given these, can you explain what the Borstal records are to people who don't?
Yeah,
know?
Rachel can.
Yeah.
Basically, we found them at the Nottingham Gallows of Justice, and there was just two records from different time periods, but it was when Aylesbury Borstal was for young girls. And essentially the record would give you information on their name, you know, biographical details, but it would also give you a little note on their behaviour, and also, which was really illuminating, a little note by the medical officer who would examine them when they went in and would be responsible for their medical care. And some of what Flo and Paul are alluding to is there's some really nice quotes, well, they're not nice, but, you know, they're nice for us, where the medical officer is kind of saying, you know, they're lazy and they're misbehaved and they're troublesome and they're this and they're that. based purely on a very brief medical examination based on their history rather than based on actually observing them for any length of time. And I think that is what particularly interested.
Well, yes,
the terminology,
but it was the terminology. But for me, it was the pattern. Like if you imagine you're kind of like conducting a symphony where it's literally going through these records and it's like lazy, 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 arrogant, lazy, thinks too much of himself, lazy, fat, arrogant, and then suddenly there's needs someone to look after her, and it's and I'm just like what, and then it's gone. So you've got these tiny little kernels of information. Which already gives you, at least gives me all this sense of the nature of the person who's making these notes, as well as like the women who are coming, who are largely 19 or 20, who are often there because of stealing. And then you think, why are they there for stealing? Are they there because they need something? Are they there, and are they there because they have they're kleptomaniacs? Like what has led them to stealing? And then you have this other thing about what is it about this one woman? Needs someone to care for her, that after like 20 pages of lazy, lazy, arrogant, lazy, arrogant, fat, is needs, and then suddenly I start thinking, what is the story of this woman? What is also the story of this man? And what is the culture that leads to all these young women ending up in this cell and with all these similarities for going in for similar reasons? So that's kind of what I mean by imagining the stories in the gaps, if that makes sense. And I guess within the patterns as
yeah,
well.
Particularly, we don't have the women's voices very often.
Yes.
And
yes.
Rachel mentioned two memoirs, but these are written by well-to-do, highly literate women who do try. They do try to talk about the experiences of the women in prison, and they see that as part of their role to really speak for the female prisoners who can't speak for themselves. But these sort of sources are so scarce, and that's partly why these gaps exist. You know, when we come to the point of, well, how did the women respond? What did the women say? It's like, we really don't know very much about this. Mm-hmm. And that's really nice then to have these interpretations of how they might have responded.
Those sources are amazing, those Borstal records. I've not been into an archive at all before because I'm not an academic, but I work with Rachel just to go and help take pictures. And they're just two big ledgers that we were given. And they've got photographs of the women. So Rachel was looking through one from 1903 and mine was 1945. And there's a photo of a woman from 1940, yeah, you say he was in for stealing, and that's why I was supposed to be just taking photos, but you can't help but read.
It
stopped me in the tracks after all the fat, lazy arrogance that needs someone to care for her. And like you say, what made that person, and it would have been a man, wouldn't it? It would have been a male doctor who thought they were all fat, stupid, lazy, arrogant, except for this one that needed it. The other thing that really struck me actually about the records was all the women were swabbed on the way in and the way out for sexually transmitted diseases, but the men weren't, you said. Were they the male records? They weren't, which I thought was an extraordinary thing. Anyway, not as an historian. It was a bit like a little gold mine for me.
I was so excited. I was like, no, take photographs.
So I'm just going to ask a couple more questions and then open it up. So, Kate and Paula, really, what... as I recall, my rose-tinted view of this is we gave you quite an open brief, really, to the extent that one of the artists did go, I don't know what you want us to do, and I said, we want you to do what you need to do with the material. But what responsibility did you feel to be kind of authentic, and what's the nature of the relationship between truth and art?
That's me. I'm just going to write a thesis, and I'll be back in a minute. No,
relationship between truth and art. Go.
Well, what I will say is, I suppose I think I might have been the artist who was asking lots of questions. Is what are we allowed to do or meant to do, and wanting to honor your research? But then I kind of cheated in a way because I deliberately set my piece in the future, and my reasoning for setting the piece in the future was partly to do with being interested in what was coming out of the research that you'd given me, but also I've done a little bit of work in prisons myself. Like I've done one workshop in a prison, and I used to just coincidentally live behind Holloway as well. So I have this kind of imagined idea of what that must be like. And I was also interested in contemporary research, and I thought, well, the only way I could link all these things and kind of honor the sense, I guess, that came from the actual stories was to set it in a time that hadn't happened yet. But that also, the thing I was interested in is the cycles and patterns of different practices and behaviors, and we're talking about solitary confinement, for example, and the length of the sentences, and how they sort of repeat themselves, and this idea of imagining things getting worse, and worse and worse and worse. And then that also kind of threaded it. When Hilary and I met up, we had a really big conversation about a prison in Liverpool. What year was that?
It's late 19th century, yeah.
And quite a lot of the women were Irish women, and they were rural Irish women, and they were really young, and then they were in this port town, and the vices that came with that, and they were often uneducated, and then they were treated a certain way because they were Irish, and then that made me think a lot about, we sort of dovetailed into a Brexit conversation, but of course. Yeah, which we would have done anyway. But it's funny because officially that wasn't part of the research. But it became a really, I was like, well, why did we go into that? And it was because I really saw this parallel between the way these young Irish women were treated and the prejudice that they faced being foreign as they were seen at that time. And the current conversation around immigration that's happening in this country. And I was really interested in linking those two things, but also imagining things snowballing into an even more terrible future. Because the other thing that I found interesting is change happens in a way imperceptibly. You're not paying attention, then suddenly really awful things have happened, and all the greatest atrocities have happened have largely been because people don't pay attention and they think it doesn't have anything to do with them, and then suddenly it is very much to do with you, and then it's too late. And so I kind of cheated. But I cheated with a sense of integrity of using all this actual stuff that had happened.
I've described it a lot to people when I'm sort of giving them the 1 minute pitch about why they should go and do this booth because it looks quite scary. It's a prisoner memoir from the future. That's how I see it, which I think links really neatly into your research, isn't it? This is what they might
absolutely be
like if we don't change our ways.
Yeah.
So we've got about 10 minutes for questions, if people have got questions, otherwise I'll keep asking and keep them in conversation.
I have a question. When it came to the research, and trigger warning for folks who may be affected, how did sexual abuse become evident? Because like, clearly it was happening, but was any of it evident in the archival material, or were there any things that made you think about sexual abuse? Like when you said the person like needs someone to care for them, I'm immediately thinking this person has some sort of, or this man has some sort of romantic attachment to this one person. So were there any other patterns that made sexual abuse more
blatant? I can say a little bit. I can answer sort of particle of that question. All three artists were given very specific themes. So Rachel Mars, who isn't here, had solitary confinement. Sabrina Mathews had maternity and motherhood. And I was working with resisting institutional control. Within that, I was actually able, in a way, to kind of dip into all three of those themes and other themes. But I suppose one thing that I saw in the research that made me think about potential abuse is when you look at these records of behavior, there was one report, I can't remember because we looked at so much together, but there was a medical report which was writing about the transference happened. So you'll have inmates who very often would be convinced that the warden was someone they'd been involved with in the past or was currently involved with, and even some of the memoirs that comes up is something that's a projection effectively. And the way it was written was to give the sense that this was something that, you know, these women were mentally not together, and so they were projecting it. And then when I went up with Hilary the last time before I made the piece, I said, but we have no way of knowing if these are projections or if they could be true, because of course someone within the prison position might say officially that this woman is crazy and she has these crazy ideas that we were involved in the past. And I'm sure there were projections that happened, but the thing is we just don't know because we have no sense of the agenda and the agency over the material. So it's another, from that small thing I saw thinking about that, it's a question mark and a gap.
Because I think these are the records where there were links between women who moved from the prison to
yes.
the asylum.
Yes.
Because domestic violence, sexual violence is rather hidden in the records. I mean, you can read between the lines, which historians were definitely not allowed to do, but they can. but these records are very interesting because they're often describing delusions, but these delusions, you sometimes find other pieces of evidence to show they're based in firm fact. And the Liverpool case is interesting because, as Paula mentioned, a lot of women who end up in prison, often on very short sentences, and they're in and out, in and out. I mean, some of them are through the prison system literally hundreds of times.
And quite a lot of them were sex workers as well.
Yeah, sex workers.
And a lot of them were sex workers because that was the work they were able to get, and when they went out that didn't change, and then they're back again.
And there was also some implication in several of the documents, including prison memoirs, that women, older women, might commit a crime on purpose, go into prison and recruit younger girls for prostitution. And this was something reformers were very concerned about as well. So it's there, but it's very hard to tease out. And previous work we've done on asylums, you know, you also find this hidden in a sense, both domestic violence and sexual violence, but it's very rare you come across very explicit accounts of this.
I was really interested in what you're saying about what's absent and how I think what you're describing is certain model prisoners' voices kind of get put forth, and I think like that's really challenging because it goes into like a reformist agenda, because often those prisoners may have different types of social capital in that environment. And
Rachel?
Yeah, so in what you were saying, like in talking about how these institutions need to be made better, I think like there is a flaw in that because they can't be made better. Like that is what incarceration is. It is a bad thing that we can dress up and maybe add certain benefits to or like programs, but ultimately it's like a denial of people's humanity. And like where I live in Canada, which is living a colonial legacy of imperialism, I see like racialized and indigenous women who are being incarcerated. And I think like we're talking about women's representation, and women's representation in prison is increasing. And I worry about like the language of improving maternal care, because there is the improved maternal care is to like de-incarcerate women, to not sentence them to prisons, to look for transformative solutions in the community. And like I'm curious about how that can maybe like for your work inform like a futurist kind of transformative.
I think see it's difficult because you will always come up against that there are some people who have to be in prison, and that's something that people will always say, that there are some people who, you know, they have to be in prison. I think for women, and for the maternity aspect in particular, I think you're right. Perhaps papering over the cracks of the current system isn't going to provide a lasting solution, and maybe we need to think about something more in the community, and I definitely think that's the case for women. I think you'd come up against a bit more difficulty in the case of men, but I think for women, we have worked with partner organisations, and one of them, a couple of them look at maternity care, and something that they are seeing is that a lot of these women, they haven't committed violent offences, so they're not a danger to the public, so we should perhaps be almost catching them earlier in the community and helping them, you know, that way, because like was alluded to before, that a lot of women now, a shockingly high proportion, and this is just the ones who disclose this, come from substance abuse backgrounds or indeed domestic, sexual abuse, violent partner abuse, and I think some of those are pregnant women, and they actually come to prison almost to shelter from that. Some women we've spoke to have actually said that they get an opportunity to have a safe environment, to have a baby away from that. So I think to say that prison completely just can't help some women, I think unless we set something up in the community, for some women it is, you know, I spoke to a woman at an event who had, you know, she'd been had a very difficult background, parental background, she'd had substance abuse issues, and she went to prison, and because a couple of people believed in her, you know, and really pushed her to keep her baby, she's now out of prison with that child, and she's a completely different person, and she quite confidently speaks about how it changed her life for the better. So I think if we don't have something in the community set up, for some women, the prison actually could be, if it's changed, it could be a place to almost save them, or not save them, but, you know, it could be a place to allow them to be mothers.
I'm going to ask Anna to speak a bit here, actually. I think you had an opinion on that, because obviously that's the work you do, isn't it? The Well, I think what you're describing is an intervention,
yes.
isn't it?
Yes.
It's an intervention, and but and sadly, for someone in prison, is an intervention that is better than what they've experienced in their lives. But from my perspective, and I think often from my, you know, it would never be.
It shouldn't be the
right,
first choice,
the
but
right
sometimes it is the choice.
There's
yeah.
got to be a better
yeah.
way of giving
yeah.
that intervention, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I suppose thinking historically as well, I mean, one of the striking things about, you know, talking about gender differences is women were seen as doubly guilty.
Yeah.
So in the 19th century, so they were seen as guilty of committing a crime, however trivial that was, but also as deviating from expectations of feminine behaviour, and particularly when you come to the area of motherhood, because
yeah.
some of these women use motherhood in very interesting ways and kind of almost put the babies between themselves
yeah.
and the prison to get better conditions, but also carried on behaving
yeah.
very inappropriately according to the prison officials. But yeah, you wonder how much there are still echoes of those sort of, you know, that double guilt really
yeah.
still applies to
it,
women.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you to, so Paula mentioned the term breaking out again, and which was a specific term that I'm going to ask Hilary to explain, because I know that something emerged as you had this collaborative discussion about the work, about the term breaking out.
Well, I mean, either Rachel or I could describe this, because it crosses both our work, because you know, it's very strong links with mental illness of women in prison. But it is a specific term that is used almost exclusively for women. I mean, men do break out, they do rebel. They often they join together, I think, much more than women, although there are incidences of women collectively rebelling in prison. But it comes back to that shock of women behaving like this. And there are some wonderful quotations from Coldbath Fields Prison in London,
yes.
where the prison governor says, look at them all in the yard, they're so meek and they're so nice, and then he gets in amongst them and, you know, all hell breaks loose. And he's, you know, particularly shocked by this and says we should be allowed to put them on the treadwheel and apply
yeah,
male
yeah.
punishments to them, because they really are awful. But this breaking out is a term that's used to women rebelling, breaking windows, tearing clothes, swearing, using vile language.
But the key thing is it's impulsive, no?
It's
that's
impulsive.
The impression. If
it's a sort of, you know,
so when men do it, it's a calculated decision to
yeah.
cause chaos. But
yeah.
with women, it's this thing we just can't control.
It's believed to be impulsive and also temporary. So that's why they don't always treat it as a health issue. They say, basically, they'll calm down. So if we put them in a separate cell for a couple of days on a bread and water diet, they'll
yeah.
calm down, but
yeah.
obviously it becomes quite cyclical. But there are instances where they do state that they're doing it because they want to be put in a separate cell, because they know that their friend's down there or
mm-hmm.
whatever. So there are some instances where, although this, in one sense they're saying it's impulsive, in another sense they're saying it's premeditated, because
mm-hmm.
they want to, I mean, and Hilary and Catherine have done a lot on this, but they want to make a feint of being mentally ill
mm-hmm.
because they'll get the hospital or they'll get better diet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But they still, in some cases, they'll still categorise it as breaking out, which
mm.
typically they think is something that's impulsive. So that's where the complexity comes
mm.
in, whether it's a health issue or whether it's a disciplinary issue, and then it impacts then how it's treated.
This is the sort of thing which I find really, I mean, like all the work we're doing this year is in some way looking at where we are now and where we're going. So, and quite often the way that artists that we're working with are doing that is to look at where we've come from in order to work out how we've got here and where it might be leading. And that's just a classic example of like understanding that kind of approach to it being a kind of a temporary, like losing the plot. I mean, and now, you know, we're in like calm down, dear, you know, is the kind of contemporary equivalent of that. Like even when you're an MP in Parliament, you get told to calm down, dear, by the Prime Minister, because, you know, that kind of understanding of women's behaviour is still part of our kind of, you know, history and consciousness. And you sort of go, you know, where is it going? Is it going to get better or is it going to get worse? Because, you know, in feminism, you have the ride of that, don't you? You think it's getting better, it's going to be all right. Oh no, it's still got a lot of work to do, you know. I think that's one of these reasons for me where, like, looking at history and artists looking at and exploring history and understanding, you know, what's happened, why are we like this now and where we might be going. It's a real gift to have that access to those provocations.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap up now, just because Rachel's doing a talk on 30 downstairs that you're all very well to go frightened to death about. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to be around. apart from the bit where Rachel goes and does her talk. We're going to be around all day. We're open till 8 o'clock tonight and tomorrow night, and we're open till 4:30 on Sunday. We'd love to put you through one of the amazing installations in between 8 and 12, so we need a bit of time to be able to do them. I would like to particularly thank Kate and all the Fuel team for making this such an easy project for us, really, and the artists, Gareth, who's not here, Rachel, who's not here, Sabrina's here, Paula, for doing lots and lots for us, thank you. And it's just been a really exciting experience. So I remember when we first talked about doing an audio piece, we were like, oh, wouldn't it be brilliant if Fuel took it? And I couldn't believe it, they took it. So we were absolutely delighted to be here in the Tate delivering those pieces. It's just brilliant. And to see, we had loads and loads of school kids in yesterday, and they were so excited to be crammed in that booth, like, and they were, you know, and sitting in the chair listening to Sabrina. And we had a young man come through who said, I would never have read that piece of research, but to hear it like that, one man who was almost in tears, who said, if only 3% of women in prison are a threat and a danger to the public, that means 97% of them aren't. Why are they in there? And he just obviously came as such a shock. And that's why art disseminating your research is so important. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Can I say one thing?
Yes.
Sorry, which is, if anyone's interested in this area, there's a really fantastic show at the Royal Court for about another week called Notes from a Field, from the Field, which just, if you, it's about the American justice system, not here, but it's really extraordinary.
This is the verbatim one, isn't
yeah.
it? The verbatim one, yeah.
And it's also
amazing.
Mostly, but not completely, about men. But there are some stories about women.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Was it really good?
Yeah, it's really brilliant. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
So thank you. No, that was great. I should have checked nobody wanted to do anything. So thank you very much. We'll release you on your way.